Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Merry Christmas, Savage Nation. And here is a gift for you from Santa Savage. Here is the best of the Savage Nation from September 2010. Well, I'm glad that I could be with you on the Savage Nation. This is AM radio. Never forget it. This is the big league. This is Yankee Stadium. This is the Yankee Stadium of the media. You know, make no mistake about it. This is the big, big arena. I had a dream about this last night. I'm deeply in touch with my subconscious, or shall I say my subconscious is deeply in touch with me, which is interesting unto itself. And in the dream, I remember thinking, God, that's good, but it's not AM radio. God, that's good, but he's not in AM radio. Because I realized this is the cauldron here. This is it. This is the big league. Every breath, every word, every inflection, every insight, every mistake is heard around the world. It's a business like no other. I was in a dental chair this morning. I went for minor dental work. And the dentist said to me, how are you doing? And I told her. She said, are you still enjoying it? I said, yes. I said, but it's very difficult. She said, why? As the drill, you know, as she scraped away at Mount Rushmore of my teeth. I said, because it's a business like no other. I said, one wrong word and you lose everything. I said, one wrong word in this business and you lose everything. I don't think there's another business like it other than politics, where one wrong word could destroy you. Do you know that? Which is why it's very sad our political class has become leaderless. It's not that they're stupid. It's not that they're incapable of leading us, some of them. It's that the times that we live in make it almost impossible to say what you really mean unless you really are so confident in what you mean is going to, you know, be supported. You don't say anything. You talk and double talk. The politicians speak in rhymes. They say nothing, so we've lost interest in them. So who do we turn to? We turn to talk radio. That's absolutely true. We absolutely turn to talk radio for any conversation today. Doesn't mean there isn't any other conversation out there. I was on a friend's yacht the other night, Labor Day, and I met some young people, younger than me by a couple of decades. They happened to be from a South American nation. Lovely couple. Young children weren't there, and we talked. They didn't even know me. I didn't know them. I was introduced by, we just had I had a beer. They had drank, blah, blah, blah. I cooked some meat, and we talked. So there are very intelligent people out there who talk with each other, obviously. But I'm talking about in the media. There's no other dialogue. Certainly it's not on ABC, CBS, or NBC. It's a format that doesn't lend itself to conversation. Television, they've tried the talk format in television. It doesn't work for whatever reason. I've seen it tried. Yes, Joan, you're on from Columbus, Ohio. What do you say, Joan? Blah, blah, blah. Somehow it doesn't grip me. Why does talk radio grip you? Why do millions of people rely upon talk radio for their link to reality? I ask myself, but I know the answer. I, Merlin the magician of talk radio, know the answer. Why? Because there's no props. There's no props. There's no makeup. There's no lights. There's no distractions. There's no flashes, every minute a flash with the news on television. You can get Petite Mal watching the news. And the crossing in the legs and the lipstick in the hair. The poor girls, what they have to do to attract your attention. I don't have any of that. And even if I could, I wouldn't cross my legs and put on lipstick for your attention. I don't have to do that. So what do I have? Nothing but my brains, my heart, my knowledge, and my voice. That's all. And if you're lucky enough to be able to combine all of that and project it out into the media, through the media to the world, you're a very lucky man. But it's all a miracle. At the end of the day, it's all a miracle. I guess I believe in miracles in that regard. Mr. Pragmatist here, Michael Savage, hard-nosed Savage, believes in miracles. It's all a miracle. You want to hear something amazing? If you open up the Bible, the Jewish prayer book, rather, I want to read one paragraph. Please indulge me. You want to hear something? Here is the morning prayer that a religious man is supposed to read every morning. Blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has formed man in his wisdom and created within him numerous orifices and cavities. It is revealed and known before the throne of your glory that if one of them were to be blocked or one of them were to be opened, it would be impossible to exist even for a short while. Blessed are you, Lord, who heals all flesh and performs wonders. Now, think about that. When was that written? Before the age of anatomy? The ancient Jews knew about arteries and veins, that if one of them were to be blocked or one of them were to be opened, it would be impossible to exist even for a short while. So let's say you're a warrior. Let's say all day long you worry about a heart attack. Oh, God, every cringe in a car. You're 32 years old, you have two children or whatever, and every second you feel indigestion, you think you're dying. Oh, my God, what's that? Cardioneurosis, every second. What you're really doing is praying, but you don't realize it. By fearing death, you're actually reaching out to God and saying, please don't kill me. I have two young children, or I'm alone. I don't want to die here in the car. I don't want to crash into a light pole. In essence, it's very funny when you think about it, but the fear of disease and fear of death, obsessional fear of death and disease, is actually a few steps removed from the worship of God. I'm the only one who's ever seen this. It was revealed to me in a dream. God told me to tell you that today. So let's say you're not only a hypochondriac of a minor order, but a major hypochondriac. What you're really doing is sublimating your wish to pray to God to keep you alive another second. And so it would be simpler if actually you stopped being a hypochondriac and you actually prayed to God six times a day and said these prayers in whatever language or whatever means you meant to. You just say, God, you know, we have all these vessels and these this and these that. And you know what? I'm enjoying my life. I'm not a bad guy. Or say to yourself what I learned to say the other day. I saw it in a Chinese fortune cookie. Do you know that I learned from a Chinese fortune cookie if it's good? Do you know that I can learn from a Chinese fortune cookie? I must have read them for 30 years and thrown them out. They're silly. I saw one the other day that I swear to God saved me. You know what it said? It saved me temporarily. It said, your virtues outweigh, your virtues outweigh your faults. That's what it said. Your virtues outweigh your faults. You know, when I get down on myself, I immediately go into that statement. When I say, oh, I did this, I did that, how come I didn't do this? Why didn't I do more push-ups? Why didn't I was nicer to this one? Why did I lose my temper? You know what that is. That's the road to perdition when you're starting with that one. Don't beat yourself up. Say your virtues outweigh your faults. We all have faults. But are your virtues more than your faults? Good. That's it. So a human being. So that's why I'm giving you this religious stuff today, because I want to. How do you feel about it, though? That's what I'm asking you. You like it or you don't like it? You want me to stop it never again? You want me to do it more? You want me to do it less? I mean, look, America has a hardcore religious base. You take a highway that runs from the east coast of Florida, and it goes all the way through the southern states. I have a friend in the media who says to me, why? He said, I listen to you on Highway 40. He said, I get you from one state to the next, all through the night, all through the day. He likes to drive in a car alone. He collects his thoughts or whatever. He said, you're on Highway 40. I pick you up Louisiana, then I get you in Texas. Then I get you in the panhandle, and then I get you in New Mexico, then I get you in Arizona. He said, you got to stay on the air. He said, Michael, you're the voice of America. How often have you been on an airplane, and you ask the flight attendant, can I have some peanuts? And she says, I'm sorry, someone has a peanut allergy on the plane. So there's food fascism. One cretinous, legal-oriented lunatic tells you you can't have peanuts in the airplane because she is allergic to peanuts. Now, what would happen if you brought your own pack of peanuts on an airplane, and when the light goes off, you order a drink, and you will take out your peanut? You're telling me that person is going to tell you to put your peanuts away? What a lawsuit that would be. I'd say, I dare you to make me put my peanuts away. This is such a fallacy, it's beyond comprehension. Yes, there are people who are allergic to peanuts, of course. They have no right to tell you not to eat peanuts on an airplane. The reason that happened is because of lawsuits against the airlines. And so, therefore, they decided it's better not to serve peanuts all because of one creep who says, I have a peanut allergy. Peanuts are great snacks if you're not allergic to them. I eat, for example, red skin Spanish peanuts with sea salt as a snack. Why do I eat the skins? Because little do you know that the skins and peanuts contain biotin, a very important nutrient. You probably haven't heard about biotin. I'm eating them right now. I'll probably eat too many, and then I'm going to need a beer at the end of the show. Mmm, delicious. I love almonds because almonds contain some remarkable protective nutrients. Remember the old days? I used to read people, we're going to serve them a feast from soup to nuts. Meals ended with nuts because nuts were rich in minerals. Many of us don't even eat nuts anymore. For various reasons.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from September 2010 from the Savage Nation. I promised you I would try to do my special shows for each day of the week, and today's specialty is going to be on ethnic foods. Many of you consider yourself proud of your ethnic heritage, and I'm going to talk about what it really means, and I'm going to ask you some questions. What ethnic foods did you eat in your family as you were growing up? And what was the most disgusting ethnic food your parents made you eat as a child? And did you see members of your family experiencing health problems as a result of eating so-called traditional ethnic foods? Those are some of the things you can call about because I think it'll be fun. But I want to now go back to a book I wrote. It's not available. It's not for sale. I am not selling books. Unlike Wallbanger, unlike the Marjo with the blackboard, this book was written in 1981. It's called The Skeptical Nutritionist, The Way of the Skeptical Nutritionist. And Macmillan Publishing published it. It's a little-known book. I may reproduce it, actually, because it's so ahead of its time. On page 6, I talk about food fascism. Did you know that even when I was a nutritionist, I was already into this? Here's what I wrote. The bookstores are lined with correct diets for the unmet masses. Social engineers, having arranged our personal lives from sexual behavior to dying, have been aided in applying their golden rules to our last frontier food. Food fascism, like other varieties of the social disease, requires lieutenants to proselytize. Not wishing to participate in any form of totalitarianism, I wrote, I intend not to dictate a correct diet for a fictional reader. Now, I wrote this back in the early 80s. So you could see I was already quite political, even though I was in the field of medical, in nutrition and health and whatnot. Now, having said that, I want to go into something else in this book because I think you'll find it very, very interesting. And it's about ethnic foods and the ethnic factor and things like that. And I want to show you how important this is, what happens to people when they shift their diets from their really traditional diets, from their authentic original diets, to some Western-style diet, what happens to them. I'm going to give you an example, and it's found on page 30 of The Way of the Skeptical Nutritionist. Again, it's not available for sale. Maybe you could find it used. You know that some of my used books are selling for hundreds of dollars? I was shocked. I went on Amazon, and my book, Healing Children Naturally, in the original version, is going up to $140. You could buy it for like $20 on my site. But anyway, look what I wrote. An example of disease states that can be induced. Okay, let's start from the top. Are you worried about diabetes? Has your doctor told you it's related to diet and exercise? Or just put you on a little pill? Listen to one paragraph. An example of disease states that can be induced as a result of severe and dramatic dietary changes can be found amongst the Yemenite Jewish people. For example, the Kurds and Yemenites who came to Israel had rates of diabetes as low as the Eskimos of Iceland and Greenland, 0.3 per thousand. Both groups lived in an isolated geographical situation with little contact with Western lifestyle, including diets. Soon after settling in areas where Western habits and diets prevail, a sharp rise in the prevalence of diabetes is noted. This is held up by a study done by A.M. Cohen in 1958, who compared the rates of occurrence in four Jewish ethnic groups in Israel based on the father's place of birth. These were Sephardic, Ashkenazi, Yemenite, and Kurdish communities. The study sample was composed of nearly 16,000 people, half males, half females, and their age distribution resembled that of the general Israeli population. Now listen to the rest of this. Even, let's say, it doesn't matter whether you're Jewish or not, if you can draw any conclusion from this, it may help you avoid diabetes. Listen. Interestingly, the lowest rates of diabetes mellitus were seen among Yemenite newcomers, 0.06%, followed by the Sephardic people, 1%, while the old Yemenite settlers had the highest rate, 2.9%, even higher than that of Ashkenazi Jews at 2.5%. So what is this all about? Dr. Goodman cites an animal experiment conducted in 1964 in which sand rats were transferred from their natural desert habitat to a laboratory environment. The rats that were transferred and their first-generation offspring exhibited inappropriate hyperglycemia associated with obesity and diabetes. Subsequent generations tended to adapt to lab conditions and displayed mild or no hyperglycemia. Here's the last line. In man, however, these adaptations do not occur as readily, as evidenced by the higher rate of diabetes among second-generation Israelis. So what did I just tell you? I just told you that in one example, diabetes rates rose when traditional people moved to Israel where the Western diet was quite prevalent. And once they started eating high-fat, high-sugar diets, they started to develop high rates of diabetes mellitus. Did you know that? And so therefore, I'm telling you that it's very important you understand who you are ethnically, what your genetic composition may be, to help you understand how you may have adapted wrongly to Western civilization, not only in terms of your diet, but in terms of everything else. Now, I don't expect you to change your life when I explain to you what the ethnic factor is. I'm not going to devise a pellet containing all known and all suspected required nutrients for each ethnic group in America. I mean, very nice. Here's your Italian pellet. Here's your Irish pellet. Here's your Jewish pellet. Here's your Ukrainian pellet. Here is your Romanian pellet. Here's your African pellet. And so on. I'm not going to do that.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Here is the best of the Savage Nation from September 2010.
I like my mama's food, it's so good to me. Her meatballs have the spice that make them taste so nice. A little wine after we dine makes you feel so doggone fine. My mama's a cooking.
All right, welcome to a Savage Nation on a Thursday day. We're talking about a food and a nutrition. And I'm focusing today on ethnic nutrition because many of us take pride in our ethnic background, as we should. And we eat what we think are ethnic meals, but in fact, I'm sorry to tell you, most of the ethnic meals that we're eating are not ethnic meals at all. Example, case in point, Italian food is not really Italian food that the average Italian ate, let's say, 150 years ago in Italy. The Italian diet then was quite sparse. It might have been a whole grain spaghetti or a whole grain noodle on the farm with some vegetables with very little animal protein. And perhaps some cheese products because they didn't kill the animal. But literally, they didn't slaughter the animal every time they ate a meal. And what you're eating is holiday meals three times a day, and you're getting the degenerative diseases associated with overly rich diets. It's the same with almost every other ethnic group on earth. And so you'd say, Jewish food. Oh, I'm going to go to the deli and have a corned beef sandwich with a pickle. And that's not Jewish food. That is 19th century holiday Polish food. Jewish food is Yemenite food. You want to really eat Jewish food? Eat a Yemenite diet. That is the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula. And what the Yemenites eat is what the ancient Israelites probably ate. And that's why some of us wind up with diabetes and heart attacks so young, because we're eating diets that we're not adapted to. Did you know this? You say, oh, come on, how do you know that? How do you know that? How do you know any of this stuff? Well, I trust my doctor. He tells me to eat what I want and just take a Lipitor. And then if I get sick from any food, just take something to digest it. That's all. And if that doesn't work, they'll cut us open and remove something. All right, well, you could live that way if you want. You know what I'm saying? While the pig, the crow, the squid, and like creatures are forbidden by the Hebrew dietary laws, saturated fats, sucrose, and chemical additives are the unclean or forbidden foods in the etiology of internal health of rational man, I wrote. Page 138 of The Skeptical Nutritionist. I'm a genius. I really am. Boy, I was smart when I was young. That's really a good paragraph. Look at that one. Where the pig, the crow, the squid, and like creatures are forbidden by the Hebrew dietary laws, saturated fats, sucrose, and chemical additives are the unclean or forbidden in the etiology of internal health of rational man. That's really good stuff. And then I wrote, I support tradition, but urge my religious friends to eliminate dangerous components of their foods developed and introduced long after biblical laws were written. But it's like talking to yourself. You go to a Jewish group, they're sticking their... They're eating Stella d'Oro, a cake in their face every 2 minutes, a sweet. They wonder why they have diabetes, and they look so bad at 50, so many. I'm serious. They've lost all concept of diet. You can't live that way. It's impossible. Some can. It is true. Some people can eat anything. I call them nutritional rogues, by the way. These are the people who you say, oh, my grandfather lived to 104. You're full of crap, Savage, because he ate everything you just said he shouldn't eat, and he drank a bottle of scotch. I said, so he's a nutritional rogue. You try it. Get back to me when you're 50. See how long you last. Right? What else did I want to tell you about? I want to read your paragraph, introduction, why I am a skeptic. Oh, this is an interesting one. I quoted Galileo, who wrote, there is no scientific work that only one man can write. Now, that was written by Galileo in the Middle Ages. Listen to this, Al Gore, you schmuck. Al Gore, schmuck. And every other putz in the academic establishment who said that all the science is in on global warming. Schmucks, idiots. You don't even know what science means, you schmucks. Here's what Galileo wrote, putz. There is no scientific work that only one man can write, schmuck. Galileo wrote that, but Al Gore said all the science is in on global warming. And then the idiots in the media said all the science is in on global warming. They're heretics. We know the earth is flat. And anyone who says the earth is round is not a scientist, said Al Gore. And then the schmucks on MSNBC snickered and went, yeah. Introduction, why I am a skeptic. Food is such a personal thing, and how anybody can dare suggest diets for others continually shocks me. And repugnant cuisine is scarcely the road to health and long life, I wrote in 1983. One more paragraph. Let's see. Hey, oh, this is good. Now, there are fine books on becoming vegetarian. Some of my closest friends are vegetarians. That's a joke. Yet we must not seek to declare as an objective truth that the plant world holds our major key to longevity. It may be true that George Bernard Shaw, Tolstoy, Wagner, Shelley, Byron, Thoreau, and other illustrious figures were vegetable eaters, but so was Hitler. In fact, the German dictator's manic depressive mood swings and associated unexpected aggressive outbreaks might easily have been somewhat controlled with a good dose of high-quality protein and unrefined carbohydrates and with a steady intake of a good vitamin mineral supplement on a regular basis. Better, Hitler should have gnawed on a big leg of lamb once a day and had a glass of wine. The well-known photo of Hitler and Eva Braun at Berchtesgaden with the maniac passed out in an armchair after eating lunch is not an image the hypoglycemically attuned researcher is likely to forget, I wrote. Diet and behavior vary in too many people for us to look for a simple set of rules as our salvation from too intense swings of mood. So, I mean, I wrote some nice stuff. You know, Hitler was a vegetarian and didn't drink either. And he was always starving. He could never get enough of anything because he was always hungry, so he invaded one country after another and killed too many people. As I said, if he ate a leg of lamb and had a drink once in a while, the whole course of history would have been altered. It's absolutely true. The book was way ahead of its time. 1981, Macmillan Publishing, out of print. I still own the copyright, so don't rip it off. I think I'll reprint it now. A Strategy for Designing a Nutritional Profile. It's a good book. Not for sale. Not for sale. And I want to tell you that the word food fascism, the phrase, I think I coined it on page 6. Food fascism. I was against it then. The bookstores aligned with correct diets for the unmet masses. Social engineers, you see, I was against them. And then I wrote, food fascism, like other varieties of the social disease, requires lieutenants to proselytize. Not wishing to participate in any form of totalitarianism, I wrote, I intend not to dictate a correct diet for a fictional reader. Now, if only Michelle Obama knew that. She dictates to you what you should eat, and then she eats ice cream in Martha's Vineyard. And you're not supposed to notice that. She came back 8 pounds heavier. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. The king has no clothes. We're living through it. Every day we see the victory garden that's outside the White House and then grow your vegetables and eat good and you're not eating right. They're going to arrest you if your child's obese. Take them away from you. And every time they're on vacation, there they are in Dearborn, Michigan, and they're eating ice cream cones. What the heck? Not good for you to eat like that. Not healthy at all. You know, practice what you preach, my friend. As I said to you last week, it all the roads go back to politics. They all come and go from politics. There's nothing more political than health and nutrition. Look what Obama did to the greatest medical system in the world. So let me read you something that I remember hearing when I was a child. He who plays his fife and eats his way will live to fife another day. Now, what does that catchy rhyme mean? He who plays his fife and eats his way will live to fife another day. Well, it means that if you eat your way, you're getting certain nutrients which are life-giving and longevity-inducing. What is whey? It's the liquid remaining after the milk has been curdled and strained and turned into cheese. There's a liquid that remains, and it's usually discarded, I believe. Now, what's in the stuff that we throw out, called whey? Well, it's rich in so many things, riboflavin, B12, magnesium, potassium, zinc, selenium. So he who plays his fife and eats his way will live to fife another day. It's the equivalent to eating whole grains as opposed to eating white bread. It's equivalent to eating brown rice as opposed to eating white rice. You know, beriberi was rampant in Asia when they ate white rice until they found out that all of the nutrients that were being thrown out in the husk of the rice were the nutrients required to prevent, for example, rickets. You know, that's an old thing you learned in high school, probably. I don't even know if they teach that anymore. Right now, they give you a pill instead. Everything they tell you to eat garbage, live like a lab rat and take a pill. And then if you get sick, go to the quack and get six more pills. That's all. But those of us who actually studied foods and what's in them and want to know how to protect ourselves from disease have written books about it. So I remember, for example, there's another thing that's coming back to mind from my great book, 20, 30 years ahead of its time, called The Skeptical Nutritionist. And this was about another topic, if only I could remember it. I'm a little hungover, frankly, from last night. I went to a big dinner, took the dog, and I drank a lot of vodka. I feel great, don't get me wrong. Don't say it's hypocritical. I believe in vodka. But vodka's a health food if you don't do it every night, which I don't. So there was a subject in here that I wanted to find. Oh, I remember. It's fava bean hemolysis. I know that's not on everyone's lips. It's a disease we know nothing about. But I remember when I uncovered it, when I was writing this book, how many doctors wrote me who were ahead of their time. They said, oh my God, Savage, how did you do this? Where'd you find it? Well, I had just gotten my PhD from the University of California, and I was very just fascinated by ethnic diets. And I studied every arcane piece of literature there was, and I came up with some interesting things. And so I found this about fava beans. I've never eaten a fava bean ever since. Now, sometimes if I go in an Italian deli, you see fava beans. And they're fine if you're not, let us say, I shouldn't say allergic to them, but that's close to what I'm about to tell you. There are individuals who do not understand that they lack certain enzymes to break down the fava beans. It's called a G6PD deficiency. I know it's too technical for you, and I don't want to do it to you, but the fact is you get very sick eating fava beans. It's equivalent to acute hemolytic anemia. And you say you don't know what that is. I'm showing you what could happen when you eat certain foods that you're not aware, you're not even able to digest. For example, it's well known that Jews, most blacks, and most Asians cannot digest dairy products directly because they are deficient in the enzyme necessary to break down milk, the milk product known as lactose or milk sugar. Jews, black people, and Asians have very low amounts of lactase, so they are to avoid dairy. Did you know that? So the medical profession, instead of telling Jews, black people, and Asians, don't eat dairy, they tell them take a pill with some lactate in it. The trick would be to avoid the dairy. Now, why would Jews, blacks, and Asians have evolved or adapted to a low dairy diets, because there weren't high dairy diets in their traditional environs. There were just not high dairy diets. Basically, there weren't high dairy diet, so they adapted to not eating dairy, and they didn't develop the enzymes necessary to break down milk sugar. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Here is the best of the Savage Nation from September 2010. Now let's go to you. Many of you believe in raw foods because you're ignoramuses and you think that you're an ant or a rat or some kind of animal in the plains. That's absurd. The fact is that you should eat cooked foods. You're a human being. It doesn't mean you shouldn't eat some vegetables or fruits that aren't cooked. But to think you should eat only raw foods is ludicrous. It's lunacy. It's another part of the folklore of the psychologically deficient liberal to think that raw foods are better for you. It's the equivalent of thinking that a gigantic bird will come from the sky and bring you back to paradise. But actually, I want to talk about food instead. And that is the issue of how ethnic foods are very important, both to know what to eat and what not to eat. I'm coming up with something very, very small here. It's called fava bean hemolysis. And there are people who cannot eat fava beans because they lack the correct enzyme to break down fava beans. And what happens? The urine becomes very dark or red. Shock may develop in bad cases and death can follow. Did you know that? This condition is caused by a lack of glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase. That's an enzyme that breaks down the fava bean. G6PD. You don't have G6PD if you are a Kurd, for example. There are people called the Kurds, as you all know. In the north of Iraq, there's a whole land called Kurdistan. And the Kurds have one of the highest frequencies of this disorder on record. And favism, which I just described, affects individuals with a Mediterranean phenotype. And hemolysis can occur within only a few hours of inhaling even the pollen of fava bean plants, or within 1 or 2 days of eating fresh or dried fava beans. So if you are a Kurd, don't eat fava beans. You say, well, what does it have to do with me? I'm not a Kurd. I don't know. Maybe you are the type of individual who has a Mediterranean background, and you also are deficient in G6PD, and you may have a hemolytic reaction and not even know it. You go to the hospital, you have dark urine, red urine, you have shock, and you don't know it's because you just ate a fava bean salad in an Italian deli. I'm trying to warn you that this kind of knowledge was known back in ancient times, going back to antiquity. As far back as Pythagoras in the 6th century B.C., 6th century before Christ, people were warned that eating this type of bean could yield death. And in the 5th century B.C., Herodotus also mentioned favism. Now, you've forgotten it, though, because we don't know anything about food in this country, of this nature, I mean. All we know is what looks good on a plate. We have geniuses who go to cooking school with pimples on their face, and they come out as long as they know how to drizzle olive oil on something and put strawberries and raspberries on steak. They think that they're a genius. But in this century, acute hemolytic anemia was reported in 1926 in a Panamanian plantation population. Well, I don't want to go into it because it's too complicated. Maybe you've learned something. But here is another example of the classic one man's meat is another man's poison. And we can all learn from this and remember not to put down our friends who may find some of our most magical food combinations totally repugnant, because the abhorrence of our favorite food can often reflect a survival instinct which we must learn to respect. Did you like that? This is all from page 29 of The Skeptical Nutritionist, not in print, so I'm not selling you anything, unlike Wallbanger or those who sell floor mats at every turn. I'm giving you information for free because it's important to do. Now, what if you're not of a Kurdish background? I'm going to just read a little bit more to you. You don't want to hear any more about that. Did you know that I can tell you what they studied, Arabs with this and Jews and this and that. I don't think Christians are affected by this at all. I think they can eat anything. I get the feeling the cracker can eat most anything. And that's why they live on mayonnaise, white bread, and scotch. Good genetic stock. They don't worry about G6PD deficiency because they never eat the stuff. They wouldn't be caught dead near a fava bean. Give them a white bread sandwich with mayonnaise and a nice scotch, and that's it. Happy as a Maasai eating the blood of an ox. I think that's funny in some way. I'm making myself laugh. I sound like a nutty professor now. Remember you had professors who would tell a joke that was so arcane only he laughed at it? And you thought he was a genius because he was laughing at something you didn't understand? I just did that because I did just say something only I understood. A guy told me this who didn't even drink. He survived World War II. He's still alive. And what he told me was every time he had a tinge of a sore throat, he would take scotch and basically gargle it. He would let it sit on the back of his throat and then spit it out. He wouldn't even drink it. He's a teetotaler. He's 85 years old. And you know it works. I swear to God. I mean, I use all the other stuff, the zinc drops, the vitamin C. I got echinacea propolis. It's all good. It all works for me. But I swear to God, they must do something. But tonight, instead of spitting it out, I think I'll swallow it. That's all. I'm going to go right down. In other words, why spit it out? It's 18 years old. The Scotch people, look how hard they worked on it. I'm not a socialist. Why spit out good Scotch? So don't generalize about people who basically have inherited the longevity gene to be a person who lives to 100 or 90. There are people with genes like that. You know that. I'm not one of them. Most of us are not like that. And you certainly shouldn't use the octogenarian's diet as an example of what you should be doing. You would have been dead at 46, some of you. You can't do it. So there are nutritional rogues. It doesn't mean that all the nutritional advice is faulty. It isn't. It is not faulty. It's life-saving. I wouldn't be here if I didn't follow it. I do practice what I preach the best I can. That's all. Mark Masters, Talk Radio Network, and Michael Savage are partners. We've been in business together since when? 2000?
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Here is the best of the Savage Nation from September 2010. The Bible's a very complicated book. It's not just about resisting temptation. There are a lot of prohibitions in the Bible, particularly for religious Jews who can't eat certain foods, certain kosher foods you can eat, non-kosher food you can't eat, certain animals you can eat, certain animals you can't eat. It's extremely complicated. I don't know if you people know it. The average person, if they're at all religious, tries to follow the Ten Commandments, which unto itself is very hard when you consider what's in there. The Orthodox Jew has to follow 313 commandments or 330-some-odd commandments. Who can do all of that? Who can remember all of that? And so you look at the religion of Islam, and the Muslim has many of the same prohibitions as the Orthodox Jew does. So I'll make it simple. For example, the Orthodox Jew won't eat pork or pig, and the Muslim won't eat pork or pig. Why? Because if you look at Leviticus 11, there's a whole list of foods you can, animals you can eat and animals you can't eat. I can't read every one of them, but it runs for two pages. Can you believe it? These are the living things which you may eat among all the beasts that are on the earth. Whatsoever parteth the hoof, and is wholly cloven-footed, and cheweth the cud, you can eat. Nevertheless, these you should not eat, of them that only chew the cud, or of them that only part the hoof. The camel you can't eat, because he cheweth the cud, and but parteth not the hoof. He is unclean unto you. Now, why would the Bible, why would the ancient Israelites be told not to eat the camel? Well, would you eat your Chevy Tahoe? It was transportation. I mean, you could argue that the rules were written some ways to avoid eating your transportation, if you wanted to be sarcastic. But it gets more complicated, because the next one says, and the rock badger you can't eat, because he cheweth the cud, but parteth not the hoof. He is unclean unto you. So what's the prohibition on a rock badger? What do they care about a rock badger to keep it alive? Then it says you can't even eat a rabbit. Why couldn't the ancient Jew eat the rabbit? It says, and the hare, because she cheweth the cud, but parteth not the hoof. She is unclean unto you. Well, the Italians eat the hare. And the swine, because he parteth the hoof and is cloven-footed, but cheweth not the cud, he is unclean to you. Of their flesh you should not eat, and their carcasses you should not touch. They are unclean unto you. Then what about in the fish in the water? Jews can't eat shrimp. Jews can't eat, you wouldn't know that, of course, going to a smorgasbord in Florida. Jews can't eat shrimp or lobster. Go tell them that down in Boca Raton. These may eat all that are in the waters whatsoever has fins and scales in the season and the rivers you can eat. But all have not fins and scales in the season and the rivers and all the swarm in the waters and of all the living creatures that are in the waters, they are a detestable thing unto you. And they shall be a detestable thing unto you, shall not eat of their flesh, and their carcasses you shall have in detestation. Whatever has no fins nor scales in the waters, that is a detestable thing unto you. Right? And what about in the air? And these you shall have in detestation among the fowls. They shall not be eaten. They are a detestable thing. The great vulture, so you can't eat vulture. The bearded vulture. The osprey, the kite, the falcon. The raven, the ostrich, the night hawk, the sea mew, the hawk, the little owl, and the cormorant, and the great owl, and the horned owl, and the pelican, and the carrion vulture, and the stork, and the heron. And the hoopoe and the bat, you can't eat them. I don't know why. What about creatures that crawl on the ground? All winged, swarming things that go upon all fours are a detestable thing unto you. And he lists the ones, or they list the ones you can eat. But listen to what you can eat. You don't even know this. Attention, Orthodox Jews. Even these of them you may eat, the locust after its kinds, and the bald locust, and the cricket, and the grasshopper. So you're allowed to actually have a grasshopper stew if you're a Jewish person. Or if you really want to go into the Bible, you can have a little locust dessert, a little locust ice cream. Why? Well, it's very interesting because when I studied nutrition, I found out that not only were these great famine foods, grasshoppers are very high in protein, incidentally. The poor Africans, after living in drought, sometimes they have nothing to eat but the locust and the grasshopper, and it keeps them alive. It's a very high source of protein. But all winged swarming things which have 4 feet are a detestable thing unto you. And they go in to the whole deal. You can't eat carrion. You right? And whatsoever goes on its paws among all beasts that go on all fours, that they are unclean unto you. Whoso touch their carcass shall be unclean unto them. And he that beareth the carcass of them shall wash his clothes. Blah, blah, blah. So you go on to the whole thing. I'm not going to read all of it. It's very interesting stuff. It's long. It's long stuff. And then it gets down to the swarming thing. You can't eat them. You cannot eat liberals because it says, whatsoever goeth upon the belly, and whatsoever goeth upon all fours, and whatsoever hath many feet, even all swarming things that swarm upon the earth, them ye shall not eat. So you can't eat any liberals, I'm sorry, for they are a detestable thing. You should not make yourself... You shall not make yourself detestable with any swarming thing that swarmeth, neither shall you make. So you see what I'm getting at? It's very complicated. This is the law of the beast and of the fowl and of every living creature that moveth in the waters and of every creature that swarmeth upon the earth to make a difference between the unclean and the clean and between a living thing that may be eaten and a living thing that may not be eaten. Let's close the book and now let's use common sense. Because I've talked about this with people for years. So you say, well, you could understand why the ancients wouldn't eat pig because they saw they were a dirty animal. The pig rolled in mud. The pig ate fecal matter. And they said it's ugly, disgusting, blah, blah, blah. So they didn't eat the pig. Then there was no refrigeration. There was no preservation. And they probably saw that some people who ate pig, the heathens, would get sick and die of trichinosis. So they said, don't eat the pig. All right, so you understand that one. That's commonsensical. But what about all the other animals? What sense does it make not to eat all of these other animals, whether it be a snake when you're starving to death, which, by the way, you can eat snake meat and live quite well on it. Why would that be in there? Who would have written that? Is that the word of God? Or is that the word of man? And so if it's only the word of man, then you what? The whole Bible is only the word of man? The ancient Israelites, you could argue, were simply trying to hoodwink the dummies in order to keep them under control because they were a proud people and a stiff-necked people and didn't listen to anybody. So he said, hey, man, I saw a bush burn over there, and God came down, and he's going to punish you unless... And so he waved a rattle, and he scared everybody, and that's how the whole thing started. You could look at it that way if you want. I mean, you could say it's all shamanism. I, I'm not going to tell you what to think. I'm not here to convert you or sell you or tell you you're great or not great. To me, religion is just exactly that. It's what you believe in. It's your business, not mine. But take a look at what's going on the earth right now with radical Muslims who don't see the world that way. These fanatics would burn down every library on earth because they would take us back to the 8th century when they burnt the Alexandria Library when they invaded Egypt. And they burnt all the books in the Alexandria Library because to them, there was only one book on earth, and that was the Quran. So they wiped out all of the learning that had been advanced in Egypt. These are the dangerous winds that we are facing on the earth today. Some of us know it. Some of us don't know it. Educated Muslims know it better than you know it. You understand what I'm saying to you? Don't assume they don't know what threats there are. The king of Saudi Arabia knows it. He knows very well he is threatened by these fanatics who would burn his kingdom to the ground if they could, which is why the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, right now, the leaders are shaking in their tents, praying to God that Israel does the work that they should be doing against Iran. So look, I've gone around and around here with the God talk. I don't even know if you want to hear any of this. And if you want to talk about it a little bit, we can do that. I mean, do you really think about these things? I think about it all the time. I don't think a day goes by that I don't think about it from morning till night. I don't know how a conscious person can't think about this. I don't understand how a person can even live without thinking about it. Now, let's say you're a person who says there can't be a God. Well, then what do you believe in? Tell me what you believe in. Stephen Hawking's? You believe in National Geographic? Every night now they're scaring you with a comet attack. You know, they've gotten so psycho on the National Geo channel. It used to be pretty good. They're into such fear-mongering. Every show, we're going to be hit by meteors and comets, wipe out Earth, look what the dinosaurs... It's like Al Gore is the producer for some reason. I'm sick and tired of hearing it already, about the meteor death of the Earth. Nothing but fear, that's all they sell. So let's go to you, the caller. Tim in Houston, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, what's on your mind?
Hey, Mike, how are you doing today?
Good.
Just wanted to say that I am an agnostic, but I actually believe there is a God, but... If I ever, you know, death comes to me and I found out that, you know, God actually wasn't a real thing, I guess I wouldn't be completely unhinged like a lot of people. My main problem is to believe in organized religion. You have to believe that every other religion is wrong. And anybody that doesn't believe, you know, say you're a Christian, then you have to believe that every Muslim's going to hell. And it's just a very unsettling thought to think that just anybody that doesn't agree with you exactly deserves to burn the rest of their lives, and it's just very unsettling to me.
So what is an agnostic as opposed to an atheist? An atheist doesn't believe in God. An agnostic hedges his bet?
Yeah, basically, you're a nature guy. You can look around you. It's pretty obvious to me that, you know, something designed, that math and just everything, life isn't an accident. So I think that definitely somebody made us. But I think that organized religion has basically just been hijacked by man.
Well, I've met people who are very big believers in God and the hereafter, but they don't believe in organized religion. They don't like it because they feel it's just a way of milking the public for money. You know, mulcting the public is the correct word. M-U-L-C-T-I-N-G, not milking. It's mulcting, which is almost the same thing. But I thank you for the agnostic call.
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from September 2010 from the Savage Nation. I was laying in bed this morning in the dark before getting out for the day, and I thought, oh God, I have to talk about God today. How am I going to do this? Oh God, I got to talk about you today. How am I going to do this? You think I just get up here and do this, right? You think it just comes out of the air. Well, no, it doesn't just come out of the air. It comes out of some long thoughts about it, like my entire life. But for today in particular, I was saying, how can Western civilization go on when our enemies are using religion as a Trojan horse method to take us over? And then I said, there's a bigger question. Yes, we have a belief in freedom of religion, but that's when the word religion has a similar meaning. When you say religion, you generally think of people who believe in God, and they believe in doing good, and they believe in leaving people alone. So you say, of course you believe in anyone's way to reach their beliefs in any way they want. Buddhist, Christian, Hindu, Jewish, Muslim, doesn't matter. Freedom of religion sounds good. But what if there's a religion that comes along that believes in order for their religion to thrive, they have to kill you or convert you? So you have to say, well, you have to curtail that. Then you have to understand that there's no such thing as an absolute when it comes to freedom of. There has to be a limitation on what you mean by religion. If the religion preaches goodness, we all agree it's good. But if the religion preaches death to others, then you have to say that's not a religion, that's a political doctrine. And that is the problem of the century. And we have a president and a media and a government that refuses to even understand the question, let alone know the answer. So it's up to us to educate them, is it not? Did you hear what I just said? Perhaps one of the most important things I've ever said in all the years I've ever been in radio, and I said it in a way that I think is quite neutral and quite right down the center line. Sure, we believe in freedom of religion, so far as the religion teaches peace and love and the brotherhood of man. But when someone uses the concept of religion to dominate the other religions or to take over a nation, then you have to say, my friend, that's not a religion. And I don't care how many cockamamie lawyers with twisted brains from NYU come out at us, you're not going to get away with it. We'll throw them in jail or we'll throw you in jail. We'll throw every cockeyed lunatic from the ACLU in prison before we let you take over our country. So just get it straight. Don't think you can run that number by me, Johnson. See, now that's the kind of leadership we're all waiting for. Someone who can actually discern reality, someone who actually knows reality, and someone who's willing to stand up for reality. Can you name one politician who's willing to say what I just said? No. No, you can't, which is why you have such wonderful faith in politicians, because you can't get an iota of truth out of most of them. They're scared to death that if they say one wrong thing, they'll be out of office. I don't even blame them. With the jackals in the media, they're afraid to say a word. But I will tell you this. We're way past worrying about the degenerates in the media. I think that every man must speak his mind, whether he be a politician, a talk show host, or whatever. In order for America to be saved, I think there's only one thing that can save us, and that's the truth itself. And I think in order to get to that truth, all of us must speak out. I'll take a call now. Joel in San Diego, welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael. My question is, just like every Italian is not in the mafia, just like every Muslim isn't involved with terrorism, when you think of the difference between the Jewish people and Zionism, do you know where you can differentiate the difference?
Yeah, well, the setup of your question is biased to begin with, because you're comparing Zionism to the mafia and Zionism to radical Islam.
I apologize for that. I'm just, is there a difference between the group of people that are just the regular go-to-work 8-to-5?
Yeah, it would be the same thing as a difference between Woody Allen and a whole man.
Okay.
Yeah, well, at least you got the joke. You know, Martin Luther King Jr., despite all of the flaws, like all of us, he was a flawed man in many ways, and we know what those flaws are. He said something that I'll never forget. I read it years later. I actually heard the man speak outside the UN in 1960-something. I remember it. It was quite stirring. He was quite an orator, and he moved me. I didn't know anything about civil rights or the civil rights movement truly at the time. I didn't pay much attention. I was a kid. But he said something I'll never forget. He said, make no mistake about it, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Those are the words of Martin Luther King Jr. Now go tell that to all of the Jew haters that you meet. Go ahead. Tell that all to the Jew haters out there. Okay, moving on. Talk Radio Network, which is an independent syndicator. I have no pressures that I don't have the pressures that people who syndicate with big companies do, where they have to answer to a lower authority.
Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
So today I'm reading a boating magazine in the toilet. I get the boating magazines for the toilet. It's a good place to peruse such heavy reading material. I like to look at the water there, the boats, the mega yachts that I can't afford, you know. But one article caught my eye. The Russian the Russian petro billionaires and the kind of boats that they're building. And the world's largest private yacht to be named Eclipse is being built by a man who's in the home of Marx, Lenin, and Stalin, which is now the hottest mega yacht market in the world, Russia, where people are still starving, where people are living like serfs. There is a class of billionaire crooks who stole the oil and commodities out of the ground. They're living like czars, and they're outflanking even the Arabs in terms of super yacht purchases. So the biggest one will be built by a guy in Russia. It'll be a 557-foot mega yacht. 557 feet, 170 meters, to be built by Blohm & Voss, a subsidiary of Germany's ThyssenKrupp Marine Systems. And that will cast a shadow over the current Lord of the Seas, the 525-foot Dubai, owned by Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, ruler of Dubai. Ha, ha, ha. Dubai. Wonder where they get all their money from in Dubai. So the Russians are now outspending the others. Russia's eighth richest man, Suleiman Kerimkov, had it all, including the 295-foot Lursen boat, ICE, when he crashed his Ferrari in Nice, and now he's in a burn ward. Now, how do they make all of this money? How do they make so much money that they can buy two and three yachts? Some of these guys own three of them. One of them gave away a yacht of about 200 feet to a friend. So who are these oligarchs, these modern czars of Russia? They're young, in their 30s or 40s. They're billionaires overnight. And as much of Russia is floundering in a post-communist collapse, a handful of high-powered crooks with good political connections succeeded in gaining control of the country's vast state-owned industries and natural resources. They literally bought them. And how did they buy them? They didn't have any money. Many of them were college professors. But they were well-connected with the government. Follow me here, because it's very similar to America. They were connected to the politicians, the corrupt politicians. And they get control of the vast state-owned industries and natural resources. How? Well, this took the form of loans for shares, deals and auctions, which some regard as the greatest scandal of the Boris Yeltsin era. And when Vladimir Putin, the old KGB chief, took over from Yeltsin, Putin was expected to undo the oligarchs' wealth. But what he said to them was, if you stay out of politics, I will not touch you. And so one of these guys bought a company called Sibneft, a company sitting on 30% of Russia's oil. You hear this? One man could buy a company called Sibneft. Remember, Russia was a socialist state. So the oil, the gas, the metals, the gold, the silver was all owned by the government. So now during privatization under Yeltsin, these crooks come along, and through corrupt politicians and payoffs, they get to buy all of these commodities, these natural resources. So this guy buys for $200 million, 30% of Russia's oil, not of his own money, but he borrows the money because of the value of the oil in the ground. So he borrows the money, he buys it. And then in 2005, Gazprom, Russia's state-owned gas company, buys out this 30% of the oil for $13 billion for Sibneft. So the guy borrows $200 million, and he makes $13 billion. You hear this? Then he buys $300 million worth for the $300 million boat, the Eclipse, he's having built. And he also owns the Chelsea England Football Club. He owns a Boeing 767 airplane, a townhouse in Belgravia, central London, a 440-acre estate in Sussex, and a villa in the south of France. He is also the governor of Chukotka and is reportedly trying to buy Silvio Berlusconi's former villa in Sardinia. I read in the article, none of the above information was made available by the secretive mogul. It says he doesn't comment on his personal property. Ranked by Forbes as the world's 16th richest man, worth $18.7 billion, this guy will add Eclipse to a private fleet that already includes three other mega yachts, 377-foot Polaris, 282-foot S. Castilla, and 160-foot Susurro. Once he had four mega yachts, but he gave away the fourth yacht, 370-foot Le Grand Bleu, complete with aquarium, cinema, and helicopter, to a business associate. Now, why am I telling you this story? Because in all nations, there arises a class of pirates with unlimited greed. They have no nation. They're transnational pirates, in my humble opinion. Seattle, Washington. Ryan, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hey, Dr. Savage. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I wanted to talk about the dogs. That's more interesting than anything else that we're covering.
Yeah, it is. Dogs are interesting. Well, I'm a dog person.
Yeah, you said that the dogs are allowed anywhere other than where food is served. And I just wanted to let you know, up here in Washington, I'm not sure whether it's a state law or federal law, but you are not allowed to ask a customer whether their dog is for service or not. They can simply say, I need this dog with me. And they
In other words, if you ask them if they're a legitimate service dog, you may make one of the fake psychos nervous, and you could affect their condition, and they could sue you, right?
Exactly.
That's the in Washington State, that's where they do animals, right? That's where they did the horses.
Hey, exactly. And I'm serving there one Friday night, and I
said, wait, what if you're working in a restaurant and a man comes in with a horse in Seattle? Can you come to any conclusion with that? What if he says, this is my service animal?
Well, I don't think we're far off the way things are going.
Yeah, you have a great governor, a terrific governor in the state of Washington. Great, great mayor in the state of Seattle, in the city of Seattle. Terrific place. So what, you're a waiter up there? What happened?
Hey, the first weekend that happened, I'm wondering, what in the world is going on? A dog's in here. You know, I'm allergic to cats. Somebody could be allergic to dogs.
Oh, my God. A cat in a restaurant, I never go back. I'm allergic to cats. I hate them.
Next weekend, I swear.
I hate cats. My throat closes up.
Customers saw that dog in there. The next weekend, three dogs are in there at the same time. And I'm sitting here wondering if
now, what happens if a dog takes a dump under a table? Tell me, you have to clean it up?
Hey, we got to clean up the puke in the bathroom, right?
Oh, my God. Do they make waiters clean up the bathrooms?
Yep.
Oh, no. Ryan, I think that's a violation of your rights as an employee. I don't believe a waiter should have to clean up a vomit in a bathroom.
We'll put up with it till we move on to something better, right?
Yeah, let's get off this topic. This is getting crazy. But, no, I see where you're coming from. But in Seattle, if a man comes in with a horse, you don't know what they're doing together. He could say it's a service animal.
Well, and
what if he says it's his partner?
You know, I don't know that the law doesn't cover that. We might not be
able to... Oh, yeah, well, the law, you know... Samuel Johnson, the great 18th century English essayist, said the law is an ass. He pretty much knew what the law was. You know who writes the law, don't you? You know who writes the law. That it brings up a very good point. No, this dog and restaurant thing is out of control. Only I should be able to bring my dog to a restaurant because he's self-controlled. He does not pee in a restaurant. He doesn't even bark. But I could see why it's a problem. Thanks for the call.
There are other topics out there. 1-800-449-8255. I, Michael Savage, will be right back.
Savage.
I almost feel like now moving away completely from the politics of the day and almost going into the bars I drank in. The people I ran into, how I feel a little hungover. I always do very good shows when I have a slight hangover. Not a very severe hangover, but a mild hangover is very, very good for radio, I find. And I've always found it to be very good for radio. I don't know what it is. Let's see, what did I do? So as the curtain of night descended upon the Savage Nation's host, yours truly, Michael Savage, I wandered up to the district known as North Beach in San Francisco, the more or less still Italian district of the city. Actually, I didn't go directly there. I walked up California. I have a certain walk I like, which I'm not going to tell you what it is because I don't want to be, let us say, accosted on the way. But I walked through Chinatown on the way to North Beach because I love Chinatown. The reason I love to walk down Grant Avenue at night is because it gives me hope to see the small merchants closing their stores at night, raising their gates, securing their wares. It reminds me of my father's little store down in New York on Ludlow Street, how they would close the gates at night and lock it up and look with a love at the merchandise that fed their family. Now, you don't see much of this anymore in America. Most of us are so removed from merchandise and being a shopkeeper.
But in essence, the small businessman, the small businesswoman, is the core of the capitalist system and always has been and probably always will be, despite the dominance of the great corporations. The small businessman is the key to the survival of a capitalist nation. Anyway, to make a long story short, I also like to see the Chinese people. I like hearing, as I walk down the avenue, the young men, the vigorous young men practicing martial arts in the upstairs studios, either through the drums. The drums are also part of the martial arts. I hear them practicing Taekwondo in some of the studios. I mean, I hear everything. I'm like Vincent the Blind Man, if you want to know the truth, because as I walk, although my eyes are open, so are my ears, and I have very sharp ears, and I listen to the sounds of the street. I don't have to know one word of Mandarin to understand what's going on. And I say to myself, you know, this gives me hope. And the reason it gives me hope is because I know that the Islamofascists will never conquer the Chinese, not in China nor in America. I said, are you kidding me? You're telling me these Tongs are going to let the Islamofascists dominate their neighborhood? Never in a million years. They disappear without you even knowing what happened. And there are so many other ethnic enclaves in this country that will never fall under the sway of the sword. That's all I can tell you. They have faced the conqueror in the past, and they have driven the conqueror out. Of course, there are, if you want to get into the history of China and its conquest, and it was conquered by the Muslims at a certain point, but I won't go into that because you don't know that half of China is Muslim and a good half of China was Muslim as a result of conquest. But in the United States of America, I can tell you right now, they don't even know this is going on. These people live in their own world, and it's kind of nice to step into a world that is separated from my world. So I walked through the Chinatown, as I said, smelling the garbage in the street, and walked across Broadway, you step across Broadway, now you're suddenly stepping into the garlic world, the world of garlic and jazz, so to speak, and you're into the Italian district. And for some reason, I went to a place that I haven't been for years. I used to hang out there a lot. It's an Irish bar. And I looked for my friend because I hadn't seen him in years. I stopped hanging out up there a number of years ago. And I went into O'Reilly's Tavern, and there was Miles, an old friend of mine running an Irish tavern. And we talked. I said, how's your son? He's 10 years old. And I haven't seen him in 5 years or more. I remember when he was a little boy in the bar. And I said, you know, I still remember what do they call those, giant dogs? Help me out. I forget. And you know those big dogs, whatever they're called, the Irish something or other. No, not an Irish setter. They're gigantic. They're hounds. They're giant. He had a dog, Fionn. They only live to six. I love this dog. I watched him grow up in the bar. This dog was so big that he, like a foot, was as bigger than my dog Teddy's entire body. And one of the most beautiful dogs in the world. But he died at six. I said, you know, Miles, I remember your first dog, Fionn. He says, oh, I had a second. And he died too. He says, now I have a third, just a wee puppy. He's still got the Irish whatever. I'm sorry I don't remember the name of the dog. I'm feeling kind of silly right now. I can't. But, you know, it was nice going in there. But on the way in, two guys offered to buy me a drink, and I never accept a drink from a stranger. I'm just that kind of girl. So I didn't accept the drink from the strangers, but we got to talk. It turns out that they're sheriff's deputies from another county in California who just happened to hear my voice and say, I can't believe our luck, and we talked. Whatever topic is on your mind will be fair game. Consumer culture. I was never into that. I try to buy something this week. I don't know what's wrong with me. I have trouble buying things. I wear the same clothing for years. I'm comfortable in it. I know it doesn't look as good. So I went out. I forced myself to buy four pair of pants the other day. And I came home. I looked at them. And I proceeded to hang them up and put them in the back of the closet. I'm saving them for an important day. I don't know what that day may be, but I'm saving them. Then I buy a new pair of sneakers. That took an hour. I almost died till he found the right size. This size, take that size, and the width, a D, an E, a double. I didn't have the old ones. Finally, I bought a pair. I said, oh, fine. Just give them to me, please. You're very nice. Put them in a bag. Then I got a yen to buy a pair of shoes. Like an idiot, I bought something that looked good. They looked like an elf shoe. I went back to like the 60s. There was like an elf shoe. Like, I knew better. Oh, that looks good. I'll wear them around the house. I was crippled from them. I put them on for 5 minutes. I couldn't walk. So I had to return them. I had to have them returned today. And it was a strange thing. Did I tell you what the dog did while the guy was trying to shoe on my foot? The first time I put my foot down on that little stand they have for the shoe, Teddy was with me. He didn't do anything. Then the next time the guy said, try the other foot on it, I put the other foot down. Teddy jumped between the foot and the guy's hands. So I try to think, what in the world does a dog perceive? What was he perceiving? So I thought maybe, trying to project my Darwinian mind to the dog, he probably thought the guy was taking my foot by putting it into with an instrument. What does he know? There's a stranger with a thing in his hand, taking his master's foot into an object called a shoe, and then like sealing it up with a lace. So he figured that was no good. It was dangerous. Then there was a miserable woman there with two dogs that gives dog owners a bad name in department stores. You know, it's a privilege to let you bring a dog in a department store, and I'm really glad they do. Because guys like me are good owners. This piece of garbage, she was from New York living in Marin. I knew the type. I saw right away where she was. So she has two rat dogs with her, one like a Maltese yapper. My dog doesn't bark. They start barking at my dog. Now, here's what starts. I'm getting my shoes on, and Teddy's minding his business. And she looks over from like 25 yards away. I don't know where. They have eagle eyes, these shopaholics. And she looks over and she says something like out loud, like she knows me. What kind of dog is that? So I'm like, what kind of dog is that? So I said, take a guess. She wants to play Brooklyn with me. I can answer in Brooklyn. What kind of dog is that? Like she's familiar already. I said, why don't you take a guess? So she says, a poodle? So I say nothing. All right, so she don't say anything, but I see she's seething already that no one answered, that I didn't answer her. A few minutes later, she walks by, and right away, the dogs start barking, her dogs. You know what she has the nerve to say out loud? Oh, honey, you don't like that dog, do you? Meaning her dog didn't like my dog. Now, I could have gotten mad, but I control myself, and I say, this is why I don't buy anything. It's why I don't go out of the house. It's why I become a recluse and do takeout. I can't take it. People are mean everywhere, wherever you go. I mean, the clerks are nice in these stores. They're very nice guys. I don't know how they put up with people. Then I always get sad in that department store because they have a piano player. It breaks my heart to hear it. I see a grown man sitting at a piano in the middle of the day, and I have the kind of kaleidoscopic mind. I know that this kid, it was like, let's say he was a C-talent musician, but he's like 45, good-looking guy in a tuxedo playing in a department store. So all I don't see that. I see sadness coming my way. Why? I see all the way back to the first grade, kindergarten, preschool. Oh, look at that. Billy's talented. Let's take lessons. And the mother and father kill themselves. They pay for the lessons. And they encourage him to go to the high school of performing farts and blah, blah, blah. And the kid becomes an artiste and he struggles his whole life. And he's living on next to nothing. And here he is, 45, playing a piano in a department store. I'm not putting the guy down. But I hear the music and I get depressed. I don't want to hear the music there. I don't want to hear a piano in a department store. Because I don't just see the guy. I see like a whole tragedy there. Well, what are you going to do? I guess they pay him something. I have no idea. So I'm not a shopaholic is what I'm saying. I sat up there on a hill looking at the bay and looking at, I fed some fish. I have a place on in a hidden place with a fish pond. It's funny, you know, the fish have babies. They haven't given up a desire to reproduce. It's funny. I guess they haven't read the New York Times. They don't realize how primitive they are. The boy fish and the girl fish still do it. And there's minnows. There's big fish and then there's minnows. I guess they haven't read the San Francisco Chronicle, realizing how gauche they are. Laying eggs. Ugh. Viviparous reproduction. Yuck. Yuck. Eggs. Ugh. Yeah, that's not cute. You know, the woman fish gets fat. Ooh, she loses her shape. She doesn't look like a drunk stew bum on Sunset Boulevard puking on herself. Going to prison for driving drunk? Ooh. That's the princess of the United States of America, a drunk stew bum who pukes on herself.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage. You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
Season's greetings from the Savage Nation. Here is the best of the Savage Nation from September 2010. So if I tell you that you're fearing death is really a desire to pray to God, I don't know that I've ever read that anywhere. That was quite original. I stumbled upon it, but that's the beauty of free thinking. That's the beauty of free thinking. I mean, if you've trained your mind to not be afraid of your own thinking and your own thoughts, and you trust in your own ability to think, you come up with wonderful insights. How long has it been since you've... How many people even have insights anymore? And they're afraid of their own mind. How many of you are afraid of your own thinking? You're terrified. You're told as a child, it starts with a child where you say, don't think so much. I was told as a child, my mother, God bless her, she was afraid of me. For me, she was afraid for me. She saw the dark eyes. I'd go into my states of thinking on my own, and they didn't know what I was doing. Little did they know they had a prophet. Your old men shall dream dreams, and your young men shall prophesy. Did you know that? Your children shall prophesy. Did you ever read that in the Bible? Did you know that? It was written, your old men shall dream dreams, and your young children shall prophesy. So sometimes parents have a kid who's sort of like that, deep, thoughtful, and they get scared. They don't know what he's doing. So they don't know what to do with him. Today they put him in a quack job. They put him on a drug. Oh, he's too introspective. He doesn't study well. He can't memorize. Take him to the quack called the pediatrician. She'll give him a pill and he'll be fine right after that. Turn him into a little drug addict. Put him on Ritalin at age 2. Make sure he can't think at all. Turn him into a zomboid who votes D or R, holds a job at an insurance company, comes home to a wife and 1.1 child. That's what you want. Make sure the child is subdued, suppressed, held down, controlled, put in the center line. Go straight, young man, go straight. Put that round peg in a round hole. Don't let that weirdo get away. That the weird one cut the weird parts off of him. Make sure he goes into a round hole or a square hole. Watch out for those kids with the oddball shapes. Those are the ones that cause the trouble. That's the conformity that we live in America today. Conformity, conformity, conformity. Many parents would rather have a drug addict as a child than a nonconformist child who they don't understand. Do you know that? I am so sick and tired of reading about an addict. Every time I open up the news, some old actress, oh, she talks all about her addiction. Who the hell cares? Oh, man, she exposed to some old actress who can't get a job anymore because her behind fell down or whatever. Now, all of a sudden, she's revealing she was an addict all those years. Like, I care. That's the role model? That's the role model? Some old Hollywood actress was an addict? Big deal. I don't even pity her. I don't know her. What do I care about her? What do I care about another actress who was an addict? That's a role model for a young child today? That they admit they're an addict. Oh, I was secretly an addict, or I'm secretly gay. I don't care. Why is that something to be proud of? Why don't you tell me about the Eagle Scout? Why don't you tell me about the young man who went to West Point and became a congressman? Why don't you tell me about the kid who invented something? I'm sick of people who did nothing but their whole pride in life is that they're a sexual deviant or they're an addict. I'm sick of it.
1-800-449-8255. MichaelSavage.com. Let's go to New York City. Joe on WOR. Go ahead, please.
How you doing, Doc? Sorry. I tried to believe in God for the longest time, but the more I look around, I see no critical thinking. I don't see a unique soul. And it's pretty much out of pessimism that, you know, I'm led to believe that we're just a bunch of wild animals. You know, you see people going nuts over trivial things such as at sports games,
Beating people up over a tennis match. I saw that. You're giving that an example. So you mean you've lost faith or you never had it?
You know, I've tried to develop it, but I the more I look around and, you know, every day that passes, it just diminishes more and more.
You mean because the world is so base? Is that it? And so you've seen the baseness of man and you feel, how can there be a God?
Yes, I do. And,
Well, what if you encountered people who are opposite of that, the good people, and you know there are good people who literally give their lives for the good. Like, for example, Christian missionaries who went to Afghanistan recently, there were ophthalmologists, eye doctors, surgeons who went there to help the blind people of Afghanistan, and these bastards blew them up and killed them. So how can you say the world is all evil?
No, I'm not saying the world is all evil, but I'm just saying that, you know, the shining stars, like the people you just described, are so few and far between, you know, compared to the masses who
but
are...
But Joe, you just touched on your own salvation. I saw what you just said. I don't even know you, but I have to tell you that if you were to expose yourself to those shining stars, how few they may be, in this sea of darkness, you yourself would find the light within yourself, and I think you'd feel a different, you'd be in a different world, Joe.
You know, I try to do it every day, Dr. Savage.
But what you're saying is you're in New York, where are you going to find it? You walk around, what you see are just robots walking around. You're feeling this alienation, is that right?
Correct.
You're looking and you think everybody is like a zombie walking around to do evil. Well, first of all, that's not true because you don't know what the next man is up to. You can't know what they're doing once they go into the office or into the hospital or into the school or into the bay. You don't know what people are doing. It's very hard to make a generic statement about people when you just see them in the street or you look in the media. The media never shows anybody good. The media never shows a decent person. Never. All they show is the evil and the evildoer. Is that correct?
No, you're absolutely right about that.
So the media is probably the most demonic force in America. It's probably the single most important reason that America is in such trouble, because the media only harps on that which is no good, that which is evil, and they constantly try to rip people down. They never, ever show, or rarely ever show, a decent person doing something good for humanity. They figure that wouldn't sell. And yet a guy like you is looking to see that. I don't know where you have to turn to find it. I'm not going to tell you where to go. I don't know where you can go, but I'm sure it's all around you. I'm sure it's somewhere in New York. All around you, there are people you never heard of who are like saints.
Yeah, you know, what brings me a little bit of hope, you know, when people like you and I talk, you know, sometimes I'll talk to, you know, a rabbi or a priest or, you know, even an imam.
Yeah, I do know. How old are you, Joe?
I'm 22.
I hear that. You're just going through that. You're going through a phase where you will come out of it. You're going through the sufferings of young Bertha phase, and I'm not trying to be sarcastic, where it's the woe is me, the world is no good, I'll never get out of this morass, it's horrible and the world is terrible. Now, you could get stuck in that and become an ordinary man, and you'll live out your life in abject misery. You'll never see a moment of peace or pleasure. Or you can swim through that mud and that murk, and you could come up for air and you'll see another world. I'm not saying that all the world you're going to see after that's going to be beautiful, but occasionally you will see that beautiful world. And there is a beautiful world out there. I don't know where you're going to find it, Joe, but you're in a city like New York. It's everywhere. There's got to be groups of people who, I don't know, save animals. What are you interested in?
I'm actually interested in food and nutrition. You know, one of my goals later in life is to kind of... you know, I'd like to influence the world of medicine to kind of get, you know, stop.
So why don't you try to link up with people who are interested in this and see if you find some nice people who talk about positive things? What it is you're only exposed to the tabloid media, whether it be television or newspapers, and all you hear is the negative, 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 the evil, the evil, the evil, the evil, the evil, till your mind can't take it anymore. When the exact opposite is what your mind is screaming for right now. There's actually a highly spiritual person within you who is dying to emerge. And I don't know how you're going to find it, but I'm as sure as I'm standing here, your life will emerge in another way, because you're looking for it or you wouldn't have called the show. You're called like downtrodden. You're called like miserable and hopeless. But you're reaching out. You're calling out. You're hoping you could find something, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Well, guess what? You just made the first step, and that's all I can do for you today. I can't do any more. I wish you well. I can't reach out from the radio through the microphone and take the kid, you know, out and for a dinner and say to him, look at this. Take a look at these saintly doctors, these Christian doctors who go to Afghanistan for no money to bring sight to the blind, and these fanatic Muslims blow them up and kill them and behead them. What can I do?
Savage.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. I hope you're all enjoying this time of year. Here is a holiday treat for you from September 2010 from the Savage Nation. I wrote a whole book on beer once. I got so into beer making, I wrote a whole book on beer. I made beer, visited breweries. I got obsessed with the additives in beer. I personally now only drink, where I can, German beer, because German beers, Bavarian beers in particular, are brewed to the strictest code in the world, the Bavarian purity law. And you may not know this, but brewers in Germany, Switzerland, and Luxembourg are the only brewers in the world who are prohibited by law from using anything but barley malt, hops, water, and yeast in their beers. But you should know this. Export varieties of these beers are only required to meet the standards of the nation and import them. So you could get a fine German beer, which is additive-free in Germany, but it could enter your country, the U.S., containing chemicals. The only exception being Bavarian brewed beers, which are still brewed according to the Bavarian brewing law. So the addition of chemical agents to beer happens to be an ancient practice. Not all of the chemicals are bad, but I'd rather not have chemicals. You should know that back in 1309, it was already a problem with wine and beer. 1309, English wine inspectors were required to take an oath to protect the public from unscrupulous winemakers. So it goes back a very long way. You look at the Bible, it's about weights and measures, because there were people who were, jiggling around the weights and changing them. And don't assume that the government is keeping an eye out for you. You know, I want to just talk about one more thing about beer. You may not know this, because I had an uncle who recently died. He lived quite long, but he got his first heart attack. It was out of the blue in his late 30s. He was a postman in New York. He was in decent shape. He got a heart attack, and then he retired. And he lived a very long time after that. You know, after a heart attack, you'll have a limited life, basically, no matter what the doctors tell you. And I couldn't understand it, although my father had a heart attack, which, God rest his soul, was probably related to the smoking dad, I'm sorry to say, and the diet and the stress you were under, the horrible things you lived through. It was not mere alcohol that was to blame for my uncle's heart attack. I researched this. Did you know that there were a series of fatal heart attacks among heavy beer drinkers between the year 1964 and 1966? Yeah, who cares? Well, you don't care. Turn the show off. Go listen to something else. I don't care. So between 64 and 66, series of fatal heart attacks. Who amongst heavy beer drinkers? Not because of the alcohol. What was discovered was that cobalt sulfate was used at that time by several brewers to make thick-lasting beer heads and upset the metabolism of heart cells. Researchers believed that cobalt locks up alpha-lipoic acid, which is needed by the vitamin thiamine, to complete an essential reaction in the metabolic pathway of the Krebs cycle. What does that mean to you? It means the heart cells of the beer drinkers were thus destroyed by energy starvation. Well, cobalt has since been banned in beer. But there may be other chemicals in beer that I think you should know about, because there's quite a few of them. Gum arabic, EDTA, papain, bromelain, may not be bad, certain enzymes, heptylparaben, hydroxybenzoate, caramel FD&C, blue number 1, red number 40, yellow number 5. I don't like artificial flavors and colors in my food at all. I don't like them in any food. You know what's funny? I like most men over a certain age, I take the baby aspirin every other night. I personally know it's beneficial. The small aspirin, you take them and it reduces the risk of a little blowout in the middle of the night where they find a stiff in the bed. So the fact is that you take the little aspirin, but I noticed something. I noticed that even Bayer, and I only use Bayer because the manufacturing of drugs is so fraught with fraud. You got a bunch of shysters now in the drug business and the vitamin business. They have pill pressing machines running in their garages day and night. You have no idea what they're putting in vitamins or in drugs. So, I mean, I studied this. I used to work for the best in the field. I know what goes on in factories. You got to understand that you're talking to an expert here. So I usually use Bayer aspirin because it's a drug standard, number one, the least amount of impurities, number two. And I was very disappointed in Bayer when I read the label to find out they were using a dye in the aspirin to give it color. Because aspirin, to me, was always dye-free. Who told them to put yellow number whatever in an aspirin, I asked myself. Why must they put dye in an aspirin when so many millions of men are using it? Why would they put dye in it? Was it some marketing decision? A lunatic who said it'll sell better if it's yellow?
I can't believe what I look at. I mean, I knew doctors who were so smart 30 years ago. They would say, look, if you're occasionally going to use a Valium, use the 5 milligram instead of the 10 milligram, because the dye in the 5 milligram is rather innocuous, while the blue dye used in the 10 milligram is very carcinogenic. That's how far we had gotten, and we know a lot about this stuff. Many of us in this field know an awful lot about it. Most of this knowledge has been lost. We're almost like ancient wisdom today. It's been lost completely. I mean, we knew a lot. We knew a lot, and I was the most populist writer of all of them. I published more books with more information than anybody in America that was good information. Mark Masters, who has syndicated me for over 9 years now, that's our job. Our job is to be watchdogs, not to be lapdogs, Mark. And I want to thank you for giving me total and absolute freedom to do so. That's the point I'm trying to make. I wouldn't have lasted a week with another syndicator. I could never have sat down after a show and been deconstructed where they say, well, you said this, tomorrow don't say that. That's would have been the end of it for me. I've had total freedom. I need total freedom to function. And Mark, I want to thank you again. I'm glad we're going to be working together. And I know the American people, who, particularly the millions and millions of people who listen to this show, are going to breathe a sigh of relief that we have this year to look forward to together.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore segment of Michael Savage.
She's real fine, my 409. She's real fine, my 409, my 409. Well, I saved my pennies and I saved my dimes.
I'm going to make a commitment today on the Savage Nation to avoid anything that is within the alimentary canal from the front to the end. We will nothing to do with anything to do with the alimentary canal for the moment. I'm going to talk about cars, classic cars. I went to a classic car show. I'm more or less a recluse, as you well know. I pride myself on reclusiveness. Now, there are younger guys who are hungry, and they need to make a buck, and they're everywhere. They're the Zelligs of the media. Wherever you turn, there they are. This Tea Party, that Tea Party. It's important stuff. Everywhere you turn, Fox News, CNN, Bill Markowitz's show, everywhere you turn, there are Zelligs in the media appearing every day in every way. Now, that's fine. I don't do it. I never like to do it, and I don't want to do it. So I basically stay in my house in pajamas, except for the occasional bicycle ride or the occasional car show or the miserable trip to a restaurant, which I always regret. Now, there's a secondary note to all of this talking here on the Savage Nation. I stayed in bed most of the weekend, and I feel great. My mind feels better. I feel calmer. I can think. So I went to a car show, the Marin Sonoma Classic Car Show out in the Marin, where was it? An outdoor thing. And I was astounded at the love for vehicles that I saw there, including my own. I mean, I can remember the cars that were there, some of them, the Duesenbergs, the 59 Vet, the Mercedes-Benz 300 SLs, the Bentley Continental from 1961, the Pierce Arrows, the 56 Continental, the 56 T-Bird. I mean, see, if I just mention the names of these cars to most of you, they actually symbolize to you various images come to your mind. And if I say to you I saw the most amazingly beautiful 1957 Chrysler 300D, and I couldn't take my eyes off it, you'll understand what I'm saying. But, you know, it's funny. Of all the cars I saw there, I had a friend I ran into, an old mechanic friend of mine. He used to fix my old Jaguars, which always broke down. He took a picture of me in front of one car. I only asked him to take a picture of me and Teddy in front of one car. It was a Model T Ford Roadster. It was so beautiful, and I wanted to picture myself in front of the Model T only because I used to build them out of plastic when I was a kid, and it just reminded me. I remember the hard rubber wheels. It all came back to me. But what I'm getting at was the crowd at the auto show, and I was thinking about a few things as I walked around looking at these stunningly gorgeous cars. I could not get out of my head, what would the Obamaites be thinking? That's all I was thinking. What would these hardcore leftist freaks in the White House think of a classic car show such as the one I went to the over the weekend? And all I could think about was these mean monsters from Harvard, these undereducated pinheads, would sort of not only look down upon classic car show such as this, but that in the future they might ban this sort of show because the cars were not green enough, or that only people with money could afford cars like this. And I started thinking as I walked around looking at these incredible classic cars, what do you think it is about car shows that angers progressives? And then I was going to ask you, do you still have a love affair with cars, or are they just box transportation to you? And then I was going to say, what does the way a person takes care of their car say about their politics? And do liberals drive differently than conservatives? I can say for sure. Genuinely, when I'm cut off, it's a lame brain with an Obama bumper sticker from the right lane. One after the other, and it's usually older women who have been disappointed in life. Either their husbands left them or they were never married, or whatever it is. They generally still drive around with the Obama, you know, for president bumper sticker in some kind of econo box, and they usually try to cut you off in the right lane, and when you don't let them in, they get furious. Like, we have merging lanes in certain parts of the area where I live. Inevitably, they know the right lane merges into the left, they know it's coming to a dead end, and it's always the, quote, nice liberals who try to speed up in the right lane. And I don't know, I won't let them in. I won't let them in. I'm a very competitive person. I don't like being cut off. So I give Wilhelm the gas, and Wilhelm gives them the fume. And they get cut off to the, you know, like, screw you. I mean, what do you mean? You're going to cut me off because you're a nice person? Because you have an Obama bumper sticker? So the cars. You know, you want to talk about cars. I don't know if you want to talk about it. You want me to get into the whole politics? Hello? That is why I'd rather talk about Janis Joplin's psychedelic-themed 1965 Porsche 356 Cabriolet. I have never been a Porsche fan. I never owned one. I never wanted to own one. I don't know what it is. Maybe the Nazi thing. I don't really know. It can't be the Nazi thing because I own a Mercedes, and that was so long ago. Who cares anyway? I mean, I love Mercedes-Benz. It's the best car I ever owned in my life. It's all I drive. I told you I have fancy cars, and I have unfancy cars. My daily driver is an S600 Mercedes. I gave it a name, Wilhelm. I don't drive around saying Wilhelm. I don't talk to it. I'm generally either driving or talking to my dog, Teddy. But the fact of the matter is, after I got this car, I never, ever needed a sports-type car. And I do own a Ferrari, a 430. I rarely, if ever, drive it. But the funny thing is that after I saw the Testarossa and the other Ferraris at the fairgrounds yesterday, actually, even though it was cloudy and horrible and miserable weather, I went all the way to a garage where I keep it, took the cover off it, and took the Ferrari from drive, because the color itself, the Ferrari red in the gray, was astoundingly beautiful. But I'm not one of these guys with the top down making believe I'm enjoying the sun. I don't know. I still don't understand that part of it. Do you? I can't understand it. Whenever there's a hot, sunny day, you see people with the top down. They're enjoying the sun. And I ask myself, did they go to the fifth grade? Did they don't understand the relationship between the sun and skin cancer, especially amongst white men over the age of 13? I mean, what are they thinking? A convertible's nice for a night, a warm, balmy night in Miami, but not for the day? What do you need sun on your face for? It's to show off. That's all it is. Now, who in this day and age thinks anyone who drives around in a convertible is rich or a celebrity? Can you answer that question? Most of the so-called loser celebrities in Hollywood drive Priuses anyway. I know that for a fact because I go to L.A. an awful lot. They wouldn't be seen dead in a new car other than some kind of hybrid. You know, hybrid. All the lowbrows are in hybrids. I love that one. But that's it. I mean, there's a lot to be said for a Rolls Royce. A Rolls Royce? In this economy? Yeah. Hello? Yes, if a man earned the money and he bought a Rolls Royce, and he loves the Rolls-Royce, who are you to tell him he can't drive the Rolls-Royce? He's paid a gas guzzler tax. That's not enough, though, for Cass Sunstein from Harvard, whose father taught him over a seltzer and corned beef how to take over the world with lies, in my humble opinion. I'm so sick of these communists, you have no idea. That's why I don't want to talk about them. I don't want to even dignify these communists from Harvard. I'll be right back.
Savage. I'm a gonna raise a holler about a working all summer just to try to earn a dollar. Every time I call my baby, try to get a date, my boss says,
no dice, son, you gotta work late.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
So I go to the car show, the classic car show. My favorite, actually, there's a number of favorites, a 57 Chrysler 300D. Unbelievable. The big Hemi engine with the twin carbs, twin four-barrel carbs. I say to my friend Alan, are they hard to keep together? He said, no, not at all. He said, he's a mechanic who's done this for 40, 50 years. I don't know how long. He said, no, they're very easy to maintain. He said, these older cars are very easy to maintain. They were much easier than the new ones. There was a 49 CAD convertible, a light green. Oh, my God, I love that car. I really always wanted like a 53 Caddy convertible. I mean, I could buy one, but I don't, because it's just more to take care of. But I realized my love affair with engines and cars and why liberals hate them. Why do liberals hate, for example, the Indy 500? Why do they hate stock car racing? Why do they hate everything to do with cars? Well, there's a number of reasons. One, let's stick to the classic car. The reason libs hate classic car shows is they represent two things that libs detest. They represent affluence, that you have enough money to maintain a car like this, and you take pleasure in showing it to somebody. That's number one. That's so unliberal. And number two, freedom. It represents the freedom to do what the hell you want with your money, not send it to Indonesia after an earthquake, for example. Like, you know, let the government take care of it. It's not my problem. Stop demanding I take care of the whole world. I really don't care about the whole world. I'd rather buy a 1957 Chrysler 300D, if you don't mind. And then, of course, it's the green thing. You know, the big greens, the liars. They fly all over the world to protest a little too much, as far as I am concerned. Let's talk about other things. My sermon. 3 pages. 2 pages. 1 minute. Thousands of years ago, a little-known man in a Middle Eastern desert tried to lead his people from idolatry and hatred. Today, the descendants of these original tribes of Israel are known as Jews. What we ask is a Jew. Is it a religion, a race, a mindset? It is, to me, a constant relationship with God, the eternal creator. A constant dialogue within ourselves, asking, pleading, demanding, to know why the God will sometimes suffer horrendous fates, or why the evil appear to enjoy why the good will sometimes suffer horrendous fates, or why the evil appear to enjoy the riches of their plunder. It is this ability to ask without hearing an answer, but to keep asking eternal questions without losing faith in goodness and godness. It is this desire to want to hear the very voice of God without hearing it. It is coming to know that the questions themselves are God's way, which makes the Jewish spirit an eternal manifestation of that transcendental experience in the desert thousands of years ago, which gives each Jewish person a special destiny, a special burden. What is it? To waste the spark of the fire of original knowledge is to throw away not only your own destiny and inheritance, but a portion of the destiny and inheritance of the people chosen by God to be his bearers of the light. Being human and not God, we all sin by missing the mark, and that is my message to my friends gathered here tonight on the Savage Nation. In Hebrew, the word sin does not exist. Did you know that? It does not exist. It translates closely to miss the mark, for God is forgiving, or not one of us listening to the show today would survive a single day. The message is to try to hit the mark again and again. That is the zen of maintaining the inheritance of God. Seek truth, seek justice. So Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year, marks the beginning of 10 days of awe, a period during which the Jewish people are judged by God, who decides whether they will be inscribed in the book of life for the coming year. It is an intense time for Jewish people, a time of trial and forgiveness. It concludes with Yom Kippur, a day of repentance. And so, as we leave the savage speech and we go into the wilderness of our own lives, I want to wish every listener to this show to remember this. Be happy. God made you. God loves you. Why does Karzai continue to wear that Boy Scout cap? I don't get it. What is that Cub Scout uniform? You know, that's so, like, third world outfitty. I mean, what? We know he's the president of a third world nation. Let's talk about Afghanistan for a minute now that I got your attention. I'm glad I got your attention. Can anyone explain to me why are we in Afghanistan? Because I still don't know. Why are men dying? Why are men fighting? Why are men getting maimed? For whom? For whom the bell tolls and why? Americans want us out of Afghanistan, incidentally. Now you say, oh, I'm shocked to hear that. We thought you were right wing. Don't you understand who I am yet? Don't you get who I am yet? Why are we in Afghanistan? I thought Obama was a peacenik. He comes to power and he increases the troop strength by 30,000. And to top it all off, in addition to increasing the war in Afghanistan, which we're not winning because of rules of disengagement, did you hear that they're actually giving medals for not fighting? Hold fire and earn a medal. You didn't hear this story. You're not going to believe it. You thought the rules of engagement under Bushki were bad. You're right. But U.S. troops in Afghanistan could soon be awarded a medal for not doing something. It would be given for courageous restraint, for holding fire to save civilian lives. I cannot believe what I'm looking at. It's as if they're saying American men are trigger happy and they go out of their way to kill civilians. You know that the enemy hides amongst their wives and children. You know that. So, this is shocking that we have a military that's been turned into such putty by the liberals.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile, my curiosity running wild. Cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go. Riding along in my automobile.
We're talking now about cars and boats and planes and how much I love machines and how I went to the classic car show. I don't go to car shows, but I did, and I realized what I'm missing. And it takes a lot of work to keep these cars, you know, looking so beautiful, I guess. They truck them there, a lot of them. I was amazed that they sat in the hot sun and they let them sit without tenting them. I was quite surprised, you know, that kind of thing. So why the liberals hate classic cars is an interesting question. All I could think about as I walked around the fairgrounds looking at the beautiful cars was liberals and why they would love to ban this sort of gathering and how they'd like to turn these cars into, recycle them into sort of, homeless shelters or something. I couldn't believe it. It's like two different universes, you know. Caterpillar C18 diesels, unbelievable engines. Unbelievable engines. And my boat just gets up and, you know, you got this 40-ton boat. You're doing 8 knots, 7 knots, 9 knots. You get her out through the Raccoon Straits, and you're heading out toward the bridge. If there are no pesky sailors or pesky the sailboats, I can dodge. At least I could see them. But the schmucks on the kayaks, I can't stand. They're as stupid as bicyclists on country roads. What do they have in their heads, these morons in kayaks? You're going out in a kayak in an open waterway, and there are boats, and we're supposed to see you in a turbulent bay, and you won't put a flag on the back of your schmuck kayak, your Nanook of the sea. How did you get your schmuck kayak to the water, I like to ask the putts. You put it on your stupid SUV and brought it there, idiot. But all of a sudden, you missed the purity. Now, I don't mind if a guy kayaks, but keep it to the side of the damn bay, or put a flag on the back of your thing so no one runs you over. So I go out, and I see the bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge, and I want to head out to the sea. So I open the engines up. That boat jumps 40 tons. If I slam the throttles forward, I don't slam them. I push them forward. I don't like stressing an engine any more than I stress myself. I grade up fast, though, and I go to, let's say, 2,200 RPM, and you'll see this boat move from 8 knots to 20 knots, 22 knots, like a fast speedboat. Think of it, 40 tons, and it'll move like that. Yes, the fuel consumption's enormous. A Cat C18, which runs about 1,000 horsepower each, you got 2,000 horsepower. When you're running at 2,300 RPM, you're burning about 52 gallons an hour on each engine. So let's say 100 gallons an hour on the boat. So that's your business? Who's paying for it, schmuck? You? I'm paying for it. You know how much of that is tax? A lot of it. If I want to burn 100 gallons an hour, that's my business. It's not your business. It's my business. That's how I see it. I'm in constant doubt about the existence of God and what he wants of me, to be frank with you. I'm plagued by doubts about the existence of God and about whether God really cares or whether I'm alone in the universe or there really is, you know, somebody up there who likes me, truthfully.
I've had events in my own life which indicate there is something other than me and something other than events around me that need explanation, for which there are no explanations. So therefore, I, at a certain point, have to go by the way of belief. I know it, you come to belief in this way, it's not a wholehearted belief, but that's the way it is with me. Maybe you hear it in my voice, maybe you hear it, you don't hear it at all, you hear a guy who's sure of himself. But when it comes to the God thing, I'm telling you the truth, some days I just don't know, because I can't understand the suffering that he permits. I can't understand the children born with diseases. I can't understand so many things that happen. And then on the other hand, I know miracles exist, and whether they're just chance occurrences. As a scientist by training, I certainly understand those who are skeptical of this whole God concept. And so therefore, I go back and forth myself.
Savage.